I couldn't be more excited to welcome Judd Brewer back to this podcast to talk about our habits around food and how to change them. So many of us have tried and failed with changing our eating habits, and it's because we have been approaching it the wrong way. The solution is simple, but not easy. Pay attention. Welcome to the Sonia Looney Show. This is a podcast about high performance and well-being. And I'm your host, Sonia. And if you're new around here, I am a world and multi-time national champion in mountain biking, and I still race professionally. I'm a health and mental performance coach, a writer, a mom of two little kids, and I own my own business. And if you're not new around here, welcome. I'm so glad that you're back, and I'm so grateful that you are a part of this awesome community and that we get to learn and grow together.
But I think as a general principle, often when we're looking at rules like, oh, here's my strength to weight ratio that some book or some coach or some YouTuber told me about, then we're not actually listening to the wisdom of our own bodies. And you've probably met athletes like this where so many of them have said, you know, I was so divorced from my own body. I wasn't listening to my body. And as soon as they started listening more to their body in terms of what they needed, they actually performed better. And on top of that, if we are eating to soothe our mood, we're not actually getting at actual mechanisms that can help us deal with whatever the mood is in the first place. So we're avoiding, you know, developing strategies to help us work with distress. And that's a really important emotional skill to develop.
Hey friends, I'm so glad that we are back together today talking about one of my very favorite subjects, habit change. And it's my pleasure to welcome back Dr. Judd Brewer. He has been on this podcast a number of times. First, to talk about his book, The Craving Mind, which I regularly reference, and also Unwinding Anxiety, another book that he wrote that I also highly recommend. And that episode in particular is one that you should go back and listen to. In those books, he talks about thinking things like thinking and worrying as a habit. And today he's back to talk about hunger as a habit in his new book, The Hunger Habit. Dr. Judd is a leading expert in habit change and the science of self-mastery, and we talk about the psychological and physical impacts of food habits, exploring how our brains are wired to associate food with reward and danger. We also talk about embodiment and how to tell if you're actually hungry. With habit, there is a habit loop that he always talks about. He has worksheets from his other books as well, but it's a cue, a behavior, and a reward, and it all comes down to that. And using mindfulness-based cues in order to change your habits. Asking questions like, what am I getting from this whenever you are doing something? And building a disenchantment databank in your mind whenever you are doing something that really isn't serving you anymore, but you feel compelled to do. Dr. Judd has successfully led smoking interventions to help people quit smoking this way. He has an Eat Right Now food app that has fueled a lot of the research for this book and helped many people change their eating habits. Some key takeaways from today. We'll talk about the neuroscience of habits, so you'll hear how our brains are wired through reinforcement learning to form food habits and associate food with reward and danger for survival purposes. We talk about true hunger and how we have lost the signal in the noise with constant food exposure and the chemical enhancements made to food, so that we can't even know if we are hungry or not. We also talk about hunger versus cravings and using mindfulness, like noting, to help differentiate physical hunger from cravings. We also talked about learning how to embrace things like uncertainty, kindness, and curiosity. And of course, the power of plant-based. And we talked about how adopting a mostly whole foods plant-based diet may enhance mood, gut health, and overall well-being. In essence, this podcast is about how to change your hunger habits using mindfulness, and it has been empirically validated. So I just highly recommend you listen to this. It is even if you're not trying to change your food habits, changing habits in general, everything that he talks about in this book is very actionable and generalizable. And these techniques were also used in his other books. So if food isn't your thing, definitely pick up The Craving Mind or Unwinding Anxiety, as worrying is a habit loop that is one that I often get stuck in. So without further ado, here is Dr. Judd Brewer. Dr. Judd, it's so good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Today we get to talk about a semi-loaded topic, food. Now, why is food so complicated for us?
Well, there's this, you know, it starts out as a survival mechanism. We all need it to survive, but then it goes to the level of social engagement. You know, how many meals do we eat with other people, whether it's family, friends, you know, banquets, et cetera. Then you add in celebrations. Then you add in, you know, consolations, whether it's a wake at a funeral or something like that. And then you add in our poor brains that have kind of mixed some wires around survival signals and soothing our moods. And so this food-mood relationship has gotten pretty complex. Oh, and should I also add that the food industry has done everything it can to get us to eat when we're not hungry?
Yeah, something that I think about a lot, because I've been eating a plant-based diet since like 2012, and we've talked about this with some friends, is that food can be something that isolates you from other people. And I didn't actually tell anybody about how I ate for 4 years because I didn't want anybody to feel weird about it. I just wanted people to feel not judged or not that they were doing something wrong. And the tribal aspect of food, like it's something that we do together, we eat together. So whenever somebody has a different habit or somebody has an unhealthy habit, like say you go home and you visit your family over the holidays and everybody's drinking a ton and eating all this junk food and you don't want to do that, then there's peer pressure. So like, how can people look at peer pressure or even the isolation piece if they're eating differently than everybody else to feel, I guess, just more content with what they're doing?
Yeah. Well, I think ultimately that comes down to being comfortable in our own skin. You know, so many things do, right? And so here, I think it can be helpful to just really start with understanding how our minds work, understanding how these habits around eating get set up. And then that ultimately gives us a pathway for working with whatever an individual pathway is and our individual journey. So whether it's, you know, eating a different diet than other people and then, you know, being comfortable in those settings, I think a lot of that comes back to, you know, just really knowing how our minds work.
So let's get into that. How do our minds work?
Well, easy question to answer. Yeah. So let's start with the, you know, we can take the pathway of eating for survival. And so all of us share this common pathway of, you know, our having to remember where food is. And in modern day, that's pretty easy. You know, I think I can imagine, I can picture how many steps it takes to get to my refrigerator, you know, and it takes even fewer steps to get to my phone if I want food delivery or, you know, all of these things, you know, 24-hour diner. So food is, for most of us, is readily available. But if you go back to our survival brains and how they got set up around this, we didn't have all of this convenience. And so we had to remember where food is, where it was. And we also had to remember where danger was so we didn't become lunch on the way to getting our lunch. And that breaks down to, you know, three elements for any learning process, a trigger, a behavior, and a result. And so if you look at the survival piece, you know, we see some food, right? That's the trigger. Then we eat the food. There's the behavior. And then our stomach sends this dopamine signal to our brain. That's the reward from a neuroscience standpoint. And that reward tells us one specific thing. It says, remember where you found this. Okay. So that's how that gets set up. It's called positive reinforcement. And then the flip side to that is negative reinforcement, where if we see danger, there's the trigger, we run away, there's the behavior, and then we are not eaten, there's the reward, we learn to avoid those places. So that's the basic premise. And then on top of that, if we look into modern day, where we're typically, you know, danger comes in different forms, whether it's an email from our boss that, you know, that is ambiguous and we're not sure if we're in trouble or not, or whether it's, you know, social media where we're comparing ourselves to other people, whether it's the food we eat or how much we eat or what we look like or all the myriad ways that we can compare ourselves to others, then we start to have these negative reinforcement processes that get set up, not out of hunger and not out of true physical danger, but out of this emotional danger where something feels bad, feels unpleasant, feels, you know, it could be anything from boredom to sadness to loneliness to anger to frustration. And then if we happen to eat some food,
our brain says, ooh, that was good because that distracted me, or it tasted good, or I got a little bit of a dopamine hit. And then we start to learn, oh, if I feel bad, I can eat this. And so that food mood relationship gets set up in the absence of hunger. That's the key piece. It's not that we're eating because we're hungry, right? That's the survival mechanism. It's that we're eating as a distraction or as a way to soothe our mood.
So yeah, I want to talk about the actual loop that you've like formatted for us, and that's been in your other books. But this is just such an interesting thing, is that we used to eat when we were hungry, but now there's so many different reasons that we eat. And there's, I don't know, do you think it's okay to eat when you're not hungry?
Well, it depends on what okay means.
I mean, do you think people should only be eating when they're hungry? Or do you think that eating to, you know, to feel better about something from time to time, you know, have your birthday cake on your birthday or whatever is a fine thing for our bodies?
Yeah. So I think it's a spectrum. So let's use the birthday example. It's probably just fine to be eating a little bit of cake and ice cream when we're not hungry at a celebration, for example. But if we get in the habit of doing that all the time, every time we want to pick me up, or every time we're sad, then it can scoot down the continuum of not so helpful and not so healthy. And on top of that, if we are eating to soothe our mood, we're not actually getting at actual mechanisms that can help us deal with whatever the mood is in the first place. So we're avoiding, you know, developing strategies to help us work with distress. And that's a really important emotional skill to develop.
Yeah. And on the other side of the spectrum is, you know, I think a lot of people listening might relate with this, is extreme restriction. So a lot of, you know, endurance athletes, they're thinking about body strength athletes' body composition or strength to weight ratio. So food becomes this thing that they shouldn't be doing. So they're not overindulging, they're underindulging, and then they're not fueling their bodies properly. So they have unhealthy habit loops around food in that regard.
Yes. And so I'm not the expert on this, but I think as a general principle, often when we're looking at rules like, oh, here's my strength to weight ratio that some book or some coach or some YouTuber told me about, then we're not actually listening to the wisdom of our own bodies. And you've probably met athletes like this, where so many of them have said, you know, I was so divorced from my own body. I wasn't listening to my body. And as soon as they started listening more to their body in terms of what they needed, they actually performed better.
Mm-hmm. And also in your book, you talked about how we're so addicted to measuring. These are something that with all the different wearable devices, people, again, are no longer intuitive about how they feel. They wake up, they're like, oh, my resting heart rate and my HRV are really good, therefore I should have a good workout today. And then they don't have a good workout today and they push through something they probably shouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. So this goes back to being disconnected with our bodies as well. So wearables, they offer a lot of promises, but don't always deliver on that promise. In that sense, if we look at food tracking, for example, wearables are notoriously terrible at being accurate with food tracking. And so if we look at our food app, instead of listening to our bodies, we're going to miss some really important signals. On top of that, you know, if we look at all these metrics, you know, these metrics are designed more and they're based on general populations. They're not based on individuals. I think over time, they will get even better at individualizing and personalizing, but we're not there yet. And so there's this draw to certainty, where we're like, oh, I know exactly what my HRV is, or my resting heart rate, or I know exactly what my VO2 max is, or I know exactly how much I ate, or I know, you know, exactly this or that. There's this, it just feels good to be certain about something as compared to being uncertain about something. Yet life is all about uncertainty. And so two problems arise from that. One is we start depending on something outside of ourselves. Two, we start getting stuck in trying to find ways to make life certain, whether it's X number of likes on Instagram or whatever, versus living and relishing the ambiguity. And then we get stuck in like always looking for that certainty and having, you know, that drive us into our comfort zone rather than living in our growth zone, which is really the most the best place to be, in my opinion. You know, it's the healthiest. It's where we grow the most. And also, it allows us to listen to the wisdom of our bodies.
That makes me think about, you know, uncertainty. And your last book, which I loved and I recommend all the time, is Unwinding Anxiety. And we're always trying to fix the problem. We're trying to think our way out of the problem. If I could just control this problem, then I can find certainty in my life. And this applies to food. If people feel this uneasiness, or in your book, you have a bunch of different ways people can identify their emotions, then they just want to eat something because it makes them feel better. Totally understand that. So like, how do we learn how to sit with this uncertainty and to be okay with it?
Well, the first place, if especially related to food, the first thing we need to do is identify that we are reaching for food outside of hunger, right? So a lot of people, they're so disconnected with their bodies, they're not actually listening to their bodies to see if they're actually hungry or not. And so they've got to be able to differentiate, you know, am I hungry or is it something else that's driving me to eat? And then they can map out whatever the behavior is. You know, am I eating out of boredom, loneliness, anger, frustration, you know, sadness, whatever. And then with that, so there are two places we can explore. One is we can explore how to let go of some of those unhealthy eating habits, but more directly to your question, we can then save all that energy and direct it toward helping us learn. You know, I think of this as learning distress tolerance, learning to be with uncertainty, learning to be with ambiguity, learning to be with unpleasant sensations like emotions, and then actually leaning into them and starting to really embrace them. You know, there's this saying, the only way out is through, or the Marcus Aurelius quote, what stands in the way becomes the way. And so we can actually see these challenging emotions as not challenging as an oh no, but challenging us to grow so we can learn from them. And then we can actually learn to be in uncertainty a lot more and even lean into it like, oh, here we go, as compared to the oh no, you know, how am I going to deal with this, or this is unpleasant, so I'm going to stuff some food down to make it go, you know, to numb myself.
Yeah, kindness and curiosity have been two major elements in your work. So can you give us examples of how to apply kindness and curiosity to changing a habit loop around food?
Sure. So let's start with kindness, because I think that is often the place to start. And just being able to recognize and see all the different ways that we beat ourselves up over food, whether we're comparing ourselves to other people, whether we're comparing ourselves to ourselves, whether it's, you know, our past self or our ideal self. And then just starting to see how we think we're dealing with the issue and checking to see how well that's actually working. So often this comes in the form of self-judgment, where we think, oh, I'm a bad person, I need to do this, or we set up these food rules where, you know, I need to eat this and not that. And all of those are ways of trying to develop certainty, trying to feel like we're in control. But ultimately, they actually just get us stuck in feeling worse, because setting up rules isn't going to actually change habits. That's not how habit change happens. And beating ourselves up just makes us feel bad. Judging ourselves makes us feel bad. So here, we can just compare what it feels like to judge ourselves versus being kind to ourselves. You know, we've done studies on this. Others have done studies on this. Anybody can do their own study with themselves, and they can just ask themselves, what feels better, kindness or meanness? You know, it's a no-brainer. So that's the place I often will encourage people to start. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think it's easier said than done, especially whenever people are comparing, or they think that things need to be a certain way in order, like an athlete might think, I have to look a certain way, or I have to weigh a certain number in order to perform. And like, people used to tell me things like this when I was a lot younger, you know, commenting. I think that I look like an athlete, but there'd be people commenting on my body, things about that they didn't think was what an athlete looked like, and things that were out of my control. And just, that was crazy. And there's a lot of pressure to try to like force yourself into a mold to look a certain way. And then when you have that pressure, there's even less kindness.
Yeah, that's a really good example. And it takes us away from why we're there in the first place, which is to perform and have fun, right? And enjoy the sport. Yeah. So I'm glad you highlight how it sounds simple, but isn't necessarily easy. It can be tremendously challenging, especially this day and age where everybody's in the spotlight thanks to social media,
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And kindness, I mean, we hear about self-compassion, but compassion and kindness are two different things. So how can people practice kindness and how can people practice self-compassion, and when is it appropriate to do either one?
Yeah, great question. So I see these two as related. And with kindness, you know, we can think of, you know, for example, anytime somebody's been kind to us or a time when we've been kind to someone else as a place to start. And so we can just practice acts of kindness and we can notice what that feels like. It's a little more straightforward than compassion, that depending on the definition that you look at, compassion requires a certain condition for compassion to arise. So we can't force compassion necessarily, but we can look to see what conditions are necessary. And the condition that is really necessary that I've seen is suffering. Somebody's got to be suffering. So if somebody else is suffering, then we might see their suffering, notice that they're suffering. And then if we don't run away from that suffering, compassion arises. And in that, compassionate response is kindness, right? There's a kindness element to it. This is also true for self-compassion. If we can really touch into our own suffering and not run away from it or judge ourselves or block ourselves from it, we can notice, oh, I'm suffering. And then that allows that natural compassion response to arise. The other thing that I find instrumental, and we've even done some research with physician burnout around compassion versus empathy fatigue, is that if we're taking that suffering personally, because suffering is unpleasant, we can actually accidentally trigger these negative reinforcement processes where if they're suffering, oh no, that's unpleasant. So we actually wall ourselves off or block that because we are thinking about it, you know, it relating to us, like, and then suddenly we're suffering and that's unpleasant. So with that, it can be very helpful just to notice that suffering is arising as compared to, you know, taking it personally, for example, even if it's our own suffering. It's like, oh, I am suffering. And that's different than, oh no, I'm suffering, which is where we tend to personalize it even more than it needs to be.
Yeah. So it sounds like number one, noticing I'm suffering. Mm-hmm. And number two, it's, are you judging the suffering?
Absolutely. Yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, you map the pattern of your habit loop. You change the reward value of your eating behavior. And then you find, and I think your wife said that's the BBO, right? Like back from the craving mind.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Find the bigger, better offer. So can we talk about, you said you can use attention to change the reward value of mm-hmm. eating behavior. So can you walk us through an example of this?
Sure. And the place I'll start is to say that this has nothing to do with willpower. And I want to highlight that because often people just think, oh, there's something wrong with me. I need more willpower. And if I could just apply willpower to this, I could change my eating habit. From a neuroscience standpoint, willpower is not even part of the discussion and it's not in the equations for behavior change. So yet the critical ingredient, as you mentioned, is awareness. And that is part of the equation. So the way it works, and we did a study published a couple of years ago where we had people pay attention as they overate and noticed how quickly their reward value and their behavior changed. And that, I mentioned that at the offset because that highlights what the question is and how we address it. And so we've got to see how rewarding a behavior is, because if we don't and it's a habit, we're just going to keep doing it. By definition, habit is automatic. So we bring awareness and we ask simple questions like, what am I getting from this? So for example, with overeating, it happens pretty quickly for somebody to notice, wow, overeating doesn't feel very good. None of my patients have come back and thanked me for helping them pay attention as they overate so they could overeat more, you know, because no one's like, oh, this is so great. How did I not notice that before? They notice pretty quickly that their body is telling them, hey, this is not very comfortable. And I'm trying to give you some signals that this is not good for you. And that's different than saying, oh, I shouldn't overeat. It's really feeling into the wisdom of the body that's saying, hey, this is not so good. And what that does, this is called a negative prediction error in neuroscience, which is just a fancy term for helping our brain see that this is worse than expected. And if we pay attention and we see that something's worse than expected, we're going to naturally become disenchanted with it. And so it's a very simple equation. And we've seen this in several studies now, where as we pay attention and something is not rewarding, we're going to naturally become disenchanted. And that boils down to a simple question. What am I getting from this? But important, feeling into the answer, not thinking, oh, I shouldn't eat this, but asking what happens when I do eat this or this amount of food.
I really like that. And that's helped me a lot. What am I getting from this question? Your work has really impacted how I've been able to change some of my habit loops, especially around overthinking. With what am I getting from this in reward value? What if somebody isn't overeating? Maybe they're just eating a little bit too much. Maybe they're indulging just a little bit too much. And it actually feels good. Like there isn't in the moment a negative reward value, but maybe the next day they're thinking like, well, that went against my values or whatever. Like how can people have enough prospection even if in the moment it still feels good?
Mm-hmm. Well, this gets at the nuance of how these equations work. And the way that boils down is if something doesn't have a negative enough value, we're not going to become disenchanted with it. Yet on the flip side, we can also find there are two ways to increase the differential, let's say, where we're going to change a behavior. So we can either see how unrewarding a certain behavior is, and or we can ask, well, what's more rewarding? And as you mentioned earlier, what's that bigger, better offer? So we can look at this during, we can also look at this after the eating behavior, and we can ask, okay, was that optimal? Did that feel good? And that includes both the physical, but also the emotional components, right? And so, like you mentioned, there might be emotional components that come out later where it's like, oh, wow, I didn't need that. You know, I didn't sleep well. Boy, that went against, you know, my values. If we're eating, for example, a lot of people eat plant-based diets just to help the planet, you know, regardless of their personal health. So there could be a lot of things that go into the equation. And so here we can ask, well, what's it feel like when I do this other behavior, does it feel better? And then we can compare the two, and that can actually help to make that differential big enough so that these small things where we might overeat a little bit, or we might, you know, indulge in, you know, something not all the time, but doesn't, you know, give us this huge negative reward value, that actually helps to open up the space where we can see, oh, well, it wasn't terrible, but it certainly wasn't as good as when I don't do it or when I do this other thing instead.
Yeah, you talk about your disenchantment data bank versus your enchantment data bank. And it seems like, you know, if there's a bit more nuance, it might take a little bit longer to fill the bank. Yeah. Whereas if you're doing something excessively, the bank fills up quicker.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Something else, we kind of already touched on it, but I just want to emphasize this because there's a lot of things that people have a hard time with whenever they're thinking way out into the future. So like maybe it's saving money for retirement, or maybe, you know, our daily habits impact who we're going to be 20, 30 years from now. But it's really hard for a lot of people to look that far into the future and change their habits because they aren't getting an immediate reward value for it.
Yes, there's a well-known phenomenon in science called delay discounting that describes what you're talking about. Yet we can all feel this in our own experience. You know, it's hard to even think 6 months down the road, you know, if we're thinking, well, I want to eat more protein and therefore, you know, it might help me build X amount of muscle mass, or I want to, you know, do this, or I want to, you know, save for retirement, you know. And the way that works is that our brains, you know, again, going back to this uncertainty principle, our brains are going to look at what's right in front of them because that's more certain. And it's the farther out in the future we look, the more uncertainty there is. So the more our brains discount the potential rewards that we might get in the future versus today. And some of the economic studies that have proven this, and I use this as an example because most people can relate to this. If somebody came up to me and I said, hey, you know, I'm going to give you $10 today, or if you come back in a week, I'll give you $11. Now the return, that it's like a, what, 10% return, you know, if you put that in the bank, no bank's going to give you 10% in a week. So it's actually a pretty good, you know, economic decision to say, well, a week it works. Yet I don't know anybody that would be like, oh yeah, I'll come back in a week and, you know, give me $11, because they're not sure what's going to be happening next week. They're not sure if I'm going to, you know, change my mind or something like that. Whereas $10 is the sure thing. And that applies to eating. That applies to staying up late at night watching television when we know, you know, we should just go to sleep. There's so many things that fall into this delay discounting principle where we think, oh, I'll even feel better tomorrow. Yet we just can't seem to turn off the television.
Which is also meant to be addicting, like food, certain food items that are made and engineered. So you said this isn't willpower, but I don't know. I agree with that. But self-regulation seems like this is part of it. So can you differentiate for us like rules versus self-regulation versus willpower?
Sure. So rules fall into the willpower camp, or I should say willpower and rules tend to go together. So for example, if we set rules, we often think, well, I need to follow the rules and, you know, I need some willpower to do that. Self-regulation, again, as a neuroscientist, I think of this from a neuroscientific standpoint. Self-regulation actually has a lot to do with how rewarding a behavior is. And so we set up these reward hierarchies in our brains that actually help us make decisions. And so often we think, oh, I made that decision. But running in the background is our brain doing all these simulations that say, oh, you know, this is going to be more preferable to that. So for example, an easy example would be, and I talk about this in The Hunger Habit, you know, broccoli versus chocolate or chocolate cake. From a caloric standpoint, you know, chocolate cake packs a lot more calories per, you know, per pound, so to speak. And so our brain's going to set up these reward hierarchies that say, hey, when given a choice between two things, pick this. Now it's going to simulate eating both of those. And it might even do this really, really quickly where we're not even that aware of it or aware of it at all. And that simulation is going to be based on past experience. So even with broccoli and cake, we can check to see, oh, if I'm really hungry, what was it like the last time I ate a bunch of cake when I was hungry versus when I ate a well-balanced meal, right? And so we can actually pause and give our brains that space to run the simulation and even make that simulation conscious. So that we can, you know, so that decision-making, that self-control, the self-regulation actually comes from the simulations that our brains are very good at doing. That's in contrast to willpower, which I'll just say is more myth than muscle.
That's so interesting to hear about. In my past, I had, I would say, just disordered patterns of eating, you know, trying to be a certain way. And it was really challenging. And I'm not saying this will work for everybody at all, but for me, it was interesting when I changed my diet to plant-based, all that kind of went away and it hasn't come back. And it was really bizarre that my entire, you know, teenage and 20s, like I changed my diet when I was whatever, at the end of my 20s, that went away. And it kind of sounds like it's because I wasn't making rule, like I guess there are quote rules around, you know, eating plant-based, but they weren't rules to me. It was just, that was just the way that I was doing things now. And I didn't have to assess, you know, am I eating this or am I eating that? It's just, this is what I'm doing. And it's hard for me to put words into that. I'm wondering if you can help me.
Yeah. I'm curious now, when you started eating plant-based, were you listening to your body more in terms of how much you needed in terms of calorie versus, you know, in protein, et cetera, et cetera? Like just listening to that wisdom of your body, or what was different?
It wasn't that I was really paying attention to that stuff per se. I think it's just that I didn't feel like I had to restrict myself. It's like, well, I'm eating a whole foods plant-based diet so I can eat as much as I want and I don't have to track my calories.
Okay. So you named a key concept here, which is I didn't have to restrict myself. Mm-hmm. So when, you know, deprivation leads to wanting, right? Whenever we you say you can't have this, then we want it even more. And so that tends to cause, you know, I'll just say problems for us, that whenever we say can't have, then our brain says want more. And so if you said, hey, all right, you can have all that you want, go for it, then you actually, you know, you open that door, you leave it wide open, and there's no pressure behind it because there's nobody banging on the door saying I want in. Does that fit with your experience?
It does. And then over time, I did start to notice how my body would feel. I wouldn't feel like a heaviness, or I wouldn't feel like what we were just talking about. I should be doing this a certain way, the thinking, the guilting. But I would notice like lightness, I guess, or like if I just eat handfuls of arugula, like I feel different immediately after I eat it. And I don't know if it's like, oh, is this a confirmation bias? Cause I know that, you know, it increases blood flow, like after you eat a high like nitric oxide food, or is it actually, you know, how I am feeling? So there's sometimes I wonder that, but I think I truly feel that way.
You're probably not alone in that. You know, I've been eating mostly plant-based for a number of years now. And so I'm a little biased there, but certainly, you know, I'm just trying to remember back to last time I had, you know, like some meat or something. And it's just like, literally you say lightness, there's a heaviness because my body's just like trying to digest this thing. And, you know, then you add in like ultra processed, you know, carbohydrate, you know, based foods. And for me, I used to get a, you know, sugar rush and crash. And that's very different than eating like a whole food, you know, meal, for example. And so I think there's a, you know, I think these, we've kind of co-evolved with food sources where we're going to feel optimal and perform optimally when we're minimally manipulating our food environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's interesting too, because once you stop eating the ultra processed foods, like I don't think everybody has to eat exactly like me, but I think getting away from the ultra processed foods is key. Once you stop doing that, then you start noticing actually, if you do eat something like that, how bad it feels because you just aren't used to it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And the, you know, people, I've noticed this and people have commented on it. It's just, you know, the mood swings, you know, it's amazing how we think, oh, this is my mood just swings all the time. Well, food equals mood, mood equals food. And so if we've got a mood swing and we're eating some comfort food, that could actually just make us swing even more. And then that starts when it starts to balance itself out. Simply by eating, say, a clean, you know, clean meals for, you know, a month or so, it's amazing how we're like, oh, yeah, my moods still shift, but I'm not on this crazy roller coaster and I actually have some control over this. It's pretty crazy.
I'm kind of going down the rabbit hole a little bit, but how you eat impacts your gut flora and your gut flora impacts your brain. Mm-hmm. So that's another kind of loop. Can you talk about how that applies to our hunger habits?
Sure. And this is, you know, there are books and books that have been written about gut flora. And I'll also say it's still an evolving science. So I'm really curious to see what else we discover in the next five to 10 years. But in short, I think you've summarized it pretty nicely where, you know, if we eat a bunch of, you know, processed food or a bunch of sugar, that's actually going to affect the microflora and that, you know, which bacteria outcompete other bacteria in our gut. And then if you add into that, you know, food coloring and preservatives and things like that, there are all sorts of things that can affect our gut flora in all sorts of different ways. And what scientists are learning more and more is that, you know, that is really critical for what our moods are and how we feel on a day-to-day basis. So there's this gut-brain interaction that is, again, you know, just starting to be explored. We're scratching the surface of this. But the bottom line is there's a lot there. And I think we can discover pretty quickly how we can affect our own, you know, gut, brain, you know, mood, food relationship just by experimenting a little bit, you know, like I love one of my favorite movies. Was Super Size Me. This was years and years ago. Where this guy goes and eats he's like, I'm going to eat McDonald's every day, three meals all day, you know, all my meals for a month. And then he tracked what happened to him. And so, you know, this won't be a spoiler, but, you know, it's not surprising that not only did his, you know, he basically made his liver into a pate, but the part that was really interesting to me as a psychiatrist was how his mood changed. So his libido changed. I think his girlfriend dumped him or almost dumped him because he was such a, you know, he was such a moody, like he turned into a moody teenager basically. And, you know, he was just like, I feel awful all the time, you know? And so that's an extreme. I wouldn't recommend people go that far to try it out, but a lot of people are actually about halfway there with their normal diets. And so I would say go halfway the other way and try just like eating unprocessed non-fast food meals, you know, for most of your days for 2 or 3 weeks and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually, we kind of got off track. This brings us back to curiosity. Like, what would happen if I ate just a little bit differently and didn't make all these rules? Like, I have to eat this way forever, but what would happen if I just tried this?
Yeah, I love that. And I think that really encapsulates curiosity in a nutshell. So often when we set up these food rules, it's the, oh no, I can't eat this, or oh no, I better eat more of this. And that, oh no, tends to make us feel closed down, constricted. And anytime we're in a confined space, it doesn't feel very good. And our mind can be a confined space. And we're creating that confined space with those food rules. Oh no, you know, I can't eat this, I can't eat this, I can't eat this. And I talk about some extreme examples of people having crazy food rules in the hunger habit, but I'm sure people have seen examples of this, if not in their own lives, in others. And so that's the opposite of curiosity. So instead of, oh no, I can't do this, we go, oh, what happens when I do this? And so it opens us up for new possibilities, but also opens that door where we don't feel nearly as confined. And it makes it a much more pleasant journey as we're discovering what actually happens when we, you know, try this versus this, as compared to saying, I can't have this.
And this comes right back to what we're talking about, self-awareness and non-mindfulness, non-judgmental self-awareness, because judgment kills curiosity immediately.
Totally.
So, you know, for people who, like, I know a lot of people listening to this podcast have heard of, you know, mindfulness. They've probably tried some meditation. But what about maybe somebody's listening and they're thinking about a family member that is completely, you know, not in tune with their body. They've never even thought about self-awareness of any kind. Like, how do you even start having those conversations to help other people?
Well, it's hard to, nobody likes somebody else to come in and tell them to change their life. So the first thing I would say is, and I've certainly noticed this in my own experience. I remember when I first got into mindfulness practice, I lost several girlfriends this way. And I was like, oh, you should try mindfulness. And they're like, oh, you should try dating somebody else. So anytime, what's the saying, a prophet's not welcome in their own town? So here it's really about living the practices. And so living, you know, the principles behind mindfulness are relatively simple, not always easy, but they're simple. It's about kindness and curiosity. And so if we live that, somebody then will come to us and say, man, what are you smoking? I want some of that. You know, and then they're open to learning. And then we just talk about our own experience as compared to saying, oh, you should do this. You know, the shoulds, that's like the food rules. And so imagine somebody imposing their rules on us.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to resist those. We're going to run away as fast as possible. So it really, it's about creating that inviting environment through our own, you know, through living it and through demonstrating it.
Can you talk about what hunger actually feels like? Because I thought that was, you had this chart in your book. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah. So, and this came from me being blown away by a basic assumption that I had when I was in, this is early in my psychiatric career, when I was working in a clinic and doing a group medical visit with a bunch of people with binge eating disorder. And, you know, I was just talking to them, asking questions, you know, like, okay, well, you know, why don't you, you know, what's it like when you're hungry? And they're like, you know, it was like stunned silence in the room. And I, you know, I was kind of thinking, you know, what did I say? And it took me a while to figure out what was going on. And finally, somebody said this. They said, oh, well, I have an urge and I eat. And that opened the door for me to realize that they had completely lost all ability to differentiate actual hunger from cravings. And in fact, there's a scientific term. It's a misnomer, in fact, because it's not, you know, the description is not accurate in the sense that it's called hedonic hunger. And I say it's a misnomer because people are eating in the absence of hunger, not when they're actually hungry. So that's why it's a misnomer, but it's used scientifically so we can study all the ways that people eat in the absence of hunger. And so these folks had lost the ability to differentiate hedonic from homeostatic hunger. Homeostatic hunger is like, you know, what's it like when we're actually hungry? And so the most telltale sign that that doesn't have other causes is just our stomach rumbling, right? So when our stomach's empty and we feel like it rumbling, you know, and there's just that distinct feeling that people describe as hunger. So here, we can be curious and we can start asking, you know, I start with a question like how recently did I eat and how much did I eat? And so, you know, if we just ate recently and we're starting to get cues of hunger, quote unquote hunger, we can start to ask, well, are these specific to actual physiologic hunger or can they be signs of other things? So for example, distractedness, irritability, restlessness, those can be signs of a bunch of different things. So we could be bored, for example. We could just be frustrated with something. And so we could be, these could be linked with eating in the absence of hunger because they are, you know, we're like, oh, I'm restless. And that restlessness has overlap with a craving for food. Or if we've learned to eat when we're frustrated, then it triggers us to eat in the absence of hunger. So there are very few specific physical symptoms, let's say, or feelings of hunger, but there are a lot that overlap. And so we can certainly look for the stomach rumbling, but then we can also look, and I have this whole checklist in the book where there's, you know, there are overlapping categories and there are non-overlapping categories where we can start to just kind of go through that checklist and see what the greatest likelihood is in factoring in how recently we ate. And what that helps us start to do is to just get back in touch with our body so that we can eventually, we don't need this checklist. We can start to really intuitively feel, oh yeah, that's true hunger or that isn't.
I also think that people can get afraid to feel hungry. Like I know that I've been in that boat. Like I'm traveling somewhere and I have to bring all this food because, well, what happens if I'm stuck on the plane and I don't want to eat the food on the plane? So what if I get hungry? So I actually have been practicing not starving myself, but just noticing if I'm hungry and if I'm hungry for a little bit, just being like, that's okay to be hungry for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that. I used to eat that way, you know, out of fear just because, you know, it was like, oh, I've got a packed day. And I would notice, you know, especially in the hospital or something, you know, when I'm totally starving, my brain does not work as well as when I, you know, when I've got proper calories. And so it could actually affect my clinical decision making. Mm. And so I would do that, just like you're talking about, kind of try to preload as compared to checking to see like, okay, is a little bit of hunger okay? And where is it where I'm getting in the danger zone where I'm in kind of in starvation mode? And, mm-hmm. you know, it's amazing how, you know, fear, if we just lean into fear a little bit, it's not so bad. It's not, you know, fear is not so scary.
So I'm looking at the time. I can't believe how fast it's gone because I thought, oh, we have tons of time. I'm going to save this. Something that I really loved in your book is you came up, well, you had a list of different meditation techniques that people can try. And I liked it because I think a lot of people are familiar with Headspace, which I actually am not a big fan of that meditation app. To me, it feels too basic and it doesn't offer a lot of room for advancement in your practice. So some of the things in your book, you had some more, in my mind, like intermediate to almost advanced things that people can try. Can you tell us about one or two of your favorites?
Sure. And I was also curious which ones you saw as intermediate to advanced. So one that we've found, and a lot of this is based on, you know, we have this app called Eat Right Now. And so we did a lot of studies to see, you know, what practices are really helpful for people. One that we found early on, even back as far as our smoking studies, was this RAIN practice that is, you know, the acronym stands for recognize, allow, or accept, and then investigate. And then we use note. Often people might have learned it as non-identification, or Tara Brach often uses nurture, which I think is really helpful. But for our purposes, it was this noting practice that can be seen as a more advanced practice as well. Although it could also be seen as a beginner practice, you know, just depends on how somebody uses it. And so, you know, that RAIN acronym encapsulates one of the practices that I found extremely helpful, this noting practice, which actually gets at this basic principle of what we think of as the observer effect. You know, by observing, you can't be identified with your emotion, your thought, or your body sensation. And so simply noting it, and we can note it out loud or we can note it silently to ourselves. You know, we have people start with just basic categories of experience, like if they're seeing, hearing, feeling, you know, feeling body sensation, smelling, tasting, that type of thing. They can just note that. And then they, as they get proficient with it, they can start to note very, very subtle body sensations. And this is extremely helpful, especially when it comes to eating, where we can start to notice tingling or tightness or burning or things like that. And that helps us differentiate things like a craving, you know, in the absence of hunger versus true body signals of hunger, for example. So the RAIN acronym is a good one. The noting practice that's part of RAIN can be done as part of it or just alone. Those are two that we find are extremely helpful for people.
Yeah, the mental noting one, that one, I learned that from a meditation or a couple meditations I did through like some Joseph Goldstein meditations.
Yeah.
And I found that to be so incredibly helpful. And then also with noting, how people can get judgmental about their noting.
Yes.
So to be gentle with your noting, but that has helped me a lot with rumination. If I start thinking and I'm overthinking and then I just say thinking and it kind of takes away its power. And the same thing can happen with a food craving.
Totally, totally. So we can note judging, for example, if we're judging ourselves, or we can simply note craving. And we can get specific with the craving, which helps, you know, if you think of a craving like a thunderstorm, where it's made up of a bunch of elements, it can seem pretty scary at first. But then when we break it down, we're like, well, okay, there's lightning. Okay, there's wind, there's water, there's, you know, there's this or that. When we break it down, it's like, oh, these elements by themselves are just elements. And this concept is what's scary. And so the noting, for example, with a craving, if we can note the physical sensations of a craving, we can start to see, oh, this is just made up of physical sensations that come and go. And in fact, I can ride these out by simply noting them. It's tremendously empowering.
Yeah. And I also think about noting emotions. Like I think you had name it to tame it, or I don't know, did you have that phrase in your book?
That I think I'd give a nod to that. I think Dan Siegel first was the person that first came up with it. And I love it, name it to tame it, because that's what noting's all about.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, learning this emotional granularity, like what is the difference between feeling frustrated and feeling angry and trying to learn those things. And I have a 1 and a 3-year-old, so I'm trying to teach the kids what they're feeling. I see them and I'm trying to note their feelings for them. So it's been a really fun practice of really, you know, learning more granularity here.
Well, and what a gift you're giving your kids, not only helping them kind of name their emotions, but help, you know, kids are really good at curiosity, but helping to foster and support. I know, exactly. Foster and support that so that they can stay curious their whole lives instead of growing up into adults that feel like they have to act like they know even when they don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even in just basic conversations, being able to, if you're having a conversation with somebody that's getting heated, like just naming an emotion out loud instead of blaming can be such a powerful thing.
Totally. Totally. It's like, oh, wow, I'm noticing that I am getting really heated right now. You know, give me a sec to take a breath. You know, nobody's going to say no.
Yeah. Let's keep going. What are some meditation techniques that did not make it into the book or got cut out of the book?
That's a great question. I was trying to include everything that has been helpful. So what got cut? I mean, really, you know, the more I do this work, and, you know, we've been doing this for a couple of decades now, the simpler things get. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that I actually cut anything that was a specific practice. You know, kindness practice is one thing we added that's in it, you know, different than my other books is, you know, I've talked about loving kindness in my other books, but we found that sometimes that can be a little inaccessible for people. And so Jackie, who's actually one of the heroes of the book, and she's lended her story to the book to give some voice to it. She actually came up with this beautiful kind of self-compassion / kindness practice that we added in as an alternative for people that are just starting or haven't had a lot of experience with loving kindness, or people who have struggled with loving kindness for years. So I would say we've actually added a few things. And, you know, I think that it's helped, you know, the longer we do things, the more we can cut stuff that's not actually that helpful or not even included in the first place. So the book isn't overly long, but I think everything has been there that's needed to be there. And I'm proud to say, nobody's asked me this question before, but I'm proud to say there's nothing that I can think of that actually got cut that I wish, you know, stayed in because, you know, because the book needed to be shorter.
That's fantastic, because I hear so many authors say that, oh, like there's all these chapters that got cut, and something that we're learning a lot, like Marty Seligman was one of our professors last semester, and one of the rules of writing these papers was write forcefully and be concise. And the word counts on these papers would just feel impossible to write about something so complex and so few words. But yeah, it's been such a great practice in learning how to not ramble on forever, which when you have no boundaries, it's easy to do that.
You know, and it highlights a good point. Something that I learned way back in residency was that the less you know, the more you say. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's a good signal to us if we're going on to actually stop and ask, do I know what I'm talking about? Because often, you know, especially with a paper deadline, for example, we can get in this mode of like, I have to write this paper, as compared to asking, have I properly researched this paper enough to write it? And so often we think, well, I just need to get started writing it. But I actually like to ask the question, have I researched it enough so that the writing will happen effortlessly and just flow? And that also helps with the brevity thing, mm-hmm. right? Because if we know exactly what we're talking about, it takes many fewer words to describe it.
Mm-hmm. Unless you overcomplicate it.
Yeah. And overcomplication is often a sign that something is, you know, might be a little off. And I say mm-hmm. that, yeah, because, you know, again, the more we have done work, the more we're simplifying things, mm-hmm. you know. And so when something is really seems really, really, really complex, you know, we might be missing something. You know, if you look at, I don't know, even to physics, you know, Einstein's theory of relativity was a pretty simple equation. Anybody can remember it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's a lot to be said about, you know, what is it that Occam's razor, the simplest explanation is usually the right one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's why after a couple decades of doing this, you didn't have to cut anything from your book.
Maybe so. Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, Dr. Jed, it was a pleasure to get to chat with you again. I hope someday we get to meet in person. Your books have been so helpful for me and for my clients and in my life. And I'm just really grateful for all the work that you've been doing.
Well, it was my pleasure.
Where can everybody find you? Find not only The Hunger Habit, but The Craving Mind and also Unwinding Anxiety.
My website's probably the easiest. So it's just drjudd.com, drjud.com.
And then you have apps as well that people could, if they want to take part in some of these behavior changing techniques, right?
Oh, yes. There's the eating app that a lot of the book is based on the research from is called Eat Right Now. The Unwinding Anxiety app is the same name as the book. And then our smoking app is called Craving to Quit. But all of those resources are also mentioned on the Dr. Jud website.
Well, thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to that episode today with Dr. Jud. It's always a pleasure to talk to him, and his work has personally touched my life. I have changed habits like quitting drinking, using the what am I getting from this question, and building that disenchantment databank. I used to have a couple drinks a week, and now I might have one or two drinks per year. And that disenchantment got so loud that I just don't even want to do it anymore. So that can be a really helpful thing because it helps you build your intrinsic motivation to change your habits instead of doing it because somebody else told you to or because you think you should, but you don't really want to. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. I am so grateful that we have been doing this for almost 7 years, which is amazing. And thank you to my team at Palm Tree Pod and to my editor, Roma, for your brilliant work in making sure this podcast is professional quality so that everyone can enjoy it. And as always, I'm with you on this journey of personal growth, adventure, and our mission to be better every day. And I'll see you right back here next week.